Okay, I think most of you, or many of you, know Derek Miller, who is our resident EAC techie, computer geek kind of guy. And if you've ever attended any of his presentations or workshops, he's very knowledgeable and highly entertaining. And he's very happy to answer any questions that you have after. Well, you might have to explain some things as you go through.
Yeah.
So he's pretty approachable, and I'm sure you'll enjoy listening to him talk.
So hi, everybody. I'm Derek. Hi, everybody.
Hi,
Derek. I got a handout, so I'm going to start here. Take one, pass around. I hope we don't run out. If we do, this handout is not directly related to anything that I'm going to talk about today. It's just I found it on the web today, and I thought it was really cool. So it would be useful for you. So there we go. As we were just talking about, you can... Yeah, Graham was just asking me if the recorder's on. It is. And my computer's recording too, so we got a backup. We're all right. I did a thing on backups a while ago, and I've learned the hard way. Record twice. So when we are recording this, we're going to put it on the website as we do with all these things. If you have any questions, ask them at any time, and I will try to remember to repeat the question so that the people here will be able to hear it, because they probably won't be able to hear you back there. So what am I here to talk about? Well, one of the reasons I would encourage questions is because I didn't know I was doing this until 2 days ago, so I haven't had a lot of time to prepare. And even if I had, I probably wouldn't have prepared. So what I'm here to talk about, we decided on the fly, was editing in the new tech world. Editing beyond what people traditionally think of when you think of editing, which is books and magazines and that sort of dead tree stuff, as the techies put it. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is why I might be useful to do this. You already heard I've sort of been in charge of the EAC, the BC branch EAC website, for about 4 years now, largely because I volunteered for... No, I was running the programs thing, so running these meetings, and nobody else knew how to update the website, so I did. And I just kept doing it after I wasn't in programs anymore. And I don't think I want to do it forever. So if one of you is interested in and has some skill, you don't need, you know, a ton. I happen to do this for a living, but you don't need to know that much. Or even if you know nothing, you can learn. Please get in contact with me, because I don't intend to be doing it until I retire. So maybe somebody else can figure it out. So I have been doing... Most of my editorial stuff does not involve paper. I work as the communications manager for a company called Navarik. This is my website here. And I use my website as a way to remember things that I can't remember normally. So I will be referring to it often. This is the company I work for. We make, as it says here, information networks for the marine shipping industry. Although I did not design it, I basically built this website. Or with some help. I figured out how it was going to be built. And I also edit most of the things in the company. If somebody has a 120-page proposal, I'm the one who runs through it at the end to make sure the words aren't misspelled and that the typefaces are correct and so on. If they have an error message which needs to say a whole bunch of things in 8 words, I'm the one they come to try and get to do it. So it spans that whole thing. I run the blog that we have here, which just sort of has interesting stuff in it about various things. So I do that. I do a whole bunch of editorial things. They call me the communications manager for the company because it sounds impressive, but for the first 8 months I worked there, I didn't even have a title because I just do a bunch of stuff, most of which has to do with writing and editing. So if you want one of those cards, these are here. I have more. I'll talk about that in a sec. The other thing I've done is, before that, I was a freelance technical writer and editor for several years while my kids were young and I was staying home. And previous to that, I worked for a software company. I'm also a musician, and as part of that, I've put a bunch of songs online. Most recently, I've been getting into something called podcasting. Do you know what that is? It's basically subscription radio shows on the internet where you say, I want to listen to this show whenever it's ready, and I'm going to listen to it whenever I'm ready, rather than having to have a certain time. So you can go on the web, and you don't have to listen to it on your computer. You can have it automatically go on your iPod, stuff like that. and I'm involved in a couple of those. They don't make any money. I make the money out here, out of my band a little bit, and the teeny bit of freelance left over, mostly for clients who are still hanging around with me, even though I don't have time anymore. So that's sort of how I came to this, and I've been a computer geek for a long time. So it all comes together. Now, I'll talk to you initially about two editing projects I've been involved with recently, one of which is the biggest editorial project I've ever been involved in my entire life, and that is this, my website. Yesterday, I discovered that I had posted, this entry here is essentially one thing that I put in here. And this one was the 2,500th one of these that I've posted since the year 2000. And by rough calculation, I think I've put about 350,000 words into those, aside from anything else that's on my website. So I've written something that's as long as War and Peace on my website. Not nearly as good as War and Peace, but it's there. And in addition to being a writing project, it is a rather large editorial project. I'm always finding stuff, I'm always fixing stuff, I'm always formatting stuff, and I don't get paid for it at all. But it has found me work, and I can't seem to stop doing it. So this is the biggest editorial thing I've ever done, because I've been doing it every single day for 6 years. And if I were getting paid for that, that'd be great, but I'm not. The second one is the most recent editorial project I did. Was anyone here at my talk last night at SFU? Good, that means I can repeat myself. And this will actually be somewhat of a surprise. This is my most recent editorial project. And what it is one of those podcasts. I'm involved in several of these podcasts. My wife has one. I'm involved with one about home recording. I do one for EAC, so you can actually subscribe to our monthly audio if you want. And I post my own songs on the internet, and so there's four. But each one of those actually has a lot of writing to do with it. Now, there's a whole chunk of audio that gets put together, and that has its own editorial process that I won't get into. But if we go to... actually, I should do the same thing I did before. This is a lot faster than the web connection I had last night, so that's good. This is one of those sites I'm involved with. Not surprisingly, I built this one too, because that's what I do. And if we post a whole bunch of things on here, but the main thing we have is every 2 weeks, we put out an episode that's about half an hour to 45 minutes long about how you can record stuff on your computer, mostly music. And each one of those episodes has what are called show notes. And they have all the links to the stuff we mentioned, sort of summarize what the episode's about, maybe you have some additional information, you know, what songs we've played, where we got photos from, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, each one of these episodes, newest ones at the top, they may have some pictures in them, you know, we got a little sponsorship that hardly pays anything but helps pay for the website and stuff. So you get this text, and I wrote this basically inside the web browser or in a text editor and pasted it in there and formatted it all up so it looks nice on there. The thing about this is, in a podcast, when somebody subscribes to it and it gets automatically put on their iPod by iTunes software or whatever, let me see if I can find it here, that the audio gets put on here, but so do the show notes. And it's actually this exact same text. It gets auto-magically reformatted and put on here in a plain text format. And what I needed to figure out in the process of doing this was how much of this formatting actually comes across. Answer is almost none, except for the line breaks. In fact, the bullets don't even come through. The links don't come through. And I discovered that initially, the program I wrote this in automatically made typographers curly quotes out of things like quotation marks and stuff. Those turn into really ugly little blotchy things on here. So I actually had to go and change the software on the website so that it didn't automatically make those curly quotes anymore, so that it would look okay on here. I'd rather have straight quotes on here and quotes that look like quotes. Yes?
When you say here...
I'll show you. I'll pass it around.
Okay. But you're not... It's not just a... iPod more than...
No, this is the iPod you buy, and what happens is on your computer, in iTunes software or wherever, you go to a website like ours, and there's a link somewhere that says subscribe, and you can click on a link, like for example here I would say I want to subscribe to this, and when I click on that, it'll take a second, iTunes pops open, and because I'm already subscribed, it's here, but it would start downloading that thing. It would show up in your list of songs or whatever in iTunes, and when I plug my iPod in there, that episode automatically gets put on here. So what it means is I listen to a whole bunch of these. I listen to Quirks and Quarks from CBC, and I listen to a bunch of other people I know, and I listen to various other things. And what it means is in the morning, I can go down, plug my iPod in, wait a couple minutes, unplug it, and then go to work while listening to these shows anytime I want. I can listen to them on the train. I can plug them into my car stereo. I can listen to them at work when I'm doing something that doesn't need words. If I'm doing images, I discovered that if I'm manipulating images, I can listen to spoken word things. I have to listen to music when I'm actually dealing with the words, because I can't do them both at the same time. But anyway, I'll show you in here what that particular... Yes?
But you can also just listen to it on your computer.
You can listen to it on your computer. You can listen to it live on there.
Okay.
You can listen to it on another device that's not an iPod that plays MP3s. You could burn them to a CD and play them in a CD player. They're just audio files that are on your computer, and there's a mechanism to get them automatically certain places. But it's the same as going to a website that says, you know, click here to play the MP3 file. You can do that on the website as well. So, but my key message here is, and I'll pass this around, if you look at the text that's on here, so I'll start here. You can turn the, just move your thumb around the wheel. Don't push on the card because that clicks the buttons and it might get, but essentially just turn the wheel and you can see that it's the same text. I'll make this go away. It's the same text I was showing you here, except with a lot less formatting. And I had to figure out how to make that formatting work and how to write it. In fact, there's some length limit that I don't know exactly what it is that will fit on there, and I've hit it a few times. So sometimes I'm scrolling through the notes on the iPod, and I discover it gets cut off halfway through a word, three-quarters of the way through my notes. So I just need to be less verbose. These are all editorial constraints that did not exist until a year and a half ago when they started making this automatically available on iPods. So that whole medium of figuring that out, everybody who's doing this has to figure it out because it just didn't exist. Nobody could teach you a course on that. So this is one of my messages about editing for websites and email and iPods and whatever other media may come up. You're going to have to, you might very well be the one who discovers the constraints of the medium. It's as if you're the person who discovered, oh, there are only two sides to a piece of paper. I can't make the assumption that there's a third side of whatever sort. You know, or that paper is different from a long scroll. Scroll has no pages, but a book has pages. It's like you discovered that. So it's interesting. It's fun. It's incredibly frustrating in many ways because you run into things that you can't imagine why the constraint exists. It may be there for an arbitrary reason, just that the programmer who wrote the software decided, well, nobody's going to need more than 1,000 characters or 3,000 characters for this, and that's what I'm going to put in there. It could be that there's a real technical reason. It might be that you never discover why. You just have to live with it, just like you never discover why your employer won't pay for spot color. You just have to live with it. You have to go grayscale. So I'm involved in a lot of that, and that's what comes out in a lot of new media publishing of various sorts is, if you get lost in there, let me know, and I can restore it. Essentially, what you got to do is, if you push the middle button, this thing here, push it enough times, and you'll see the text reappear, and then you can scroll through it. I mean, really, I'm just showing you what it looks like compared to what it looks like up here. That's the one you're looking at there. So I'm often involved, and this is a difference from what you would be doing in a traditional paper editorial environment. In a traditional paper editorial environment, in general, you can be fairly safe in that the final result is going to look like one thing. It's going to be, a magazine, and the cover designer here and the person who laid out this cell phone ad and the person who laid out these pages can be reasonably confident that once they've looked at the proofs that look like this, that's what the end result's going to look like. And, you know, if there's a mistake, if there's a comma problem, if the comma in the wrong place, if it's the wrong kind of quote, if there's a typo, you can fix that at the proof stage or somewhere, and it'll get fixed. And if it goes through, it's there forever. Websites, email, iPods, blogs, all these other things are totally different from that. You really have very little way of knowing what people are looking at when they get, you know, if you're lucky, they're looking at a website like this on a reasonably big screen, and you can, for the most part, predict what they're going to see. But they might be Windows, they might be Macintosh, they might be running Linux, they might be on a cell phone, they might be on something else, they might be reading it in a program that strips out a bunch of the information that you're assuming is there, like the iPod does. So you need to be prepared for things appearing in a bunch of different media. Typically, something I do at work, say I was talking about that 120-page proposal. If it's that long, I'll probably print it out and hand mark up, you know, proofread it by hand. But in most other instances, I never do. So maybe the end recipient prints it out, but I never do. And nobody in my office ever does, unless it's for some archive. So what that means is we're preparing it in Microsoft Word or some other program, and we turn it into a PDF file. And what that means is often you're testing your work. If it's something really important, I got to send it to somebody else in the company and say, when you open this file up, do the fonts look right? Does the formatting come out okay? Because I've got different typefaces on my computer than you do. Does it open up all right in this, you know, in Acrobat Reader on Windows when I don't have that? Does the layout work? Do the margins work okay? All that sort of stuff. It's not a matter of, okay, I've set the margins and I've got the proofs and it's done. It's, you kind of got to, you know, try a few options and then say, okay, hope for the best, and send it off. And then, you know, it gets sent to England or something and they don't have the right software and you might have to send it again or whatever. There's often this kind of cycling process about it. It gets even worse when you... Graham, yeah?
Are you going to find a support group for other people doing this kind of thing?
The question is, am I going to found a support group for this? No, because in general, people who do this sort of stuff gripe about it on their blogs. So I can just go read those, and you can read mine. We don't actually want to, you know, get too near other people. It's not quite that, but it's when you gripe about it, you tend to gripe about it on the web, and then everybody can have a big gripe fest and link to each other, and it works out fine. I talk about the frustrations, but it's great, because if I make a typo on my website, I just fix it. I do that all the time. I make a typo, or sometimes it's not uncommon for somebody who's reading my website and stumbles across some article to say, you had a typo on this article that you wrote in 2002. And I can go, oh, okay, and depending on how I feel, I might go back and fix it. And then it's fixed, and then it's not going to be there anymore. So that's a great benefit, because you don't get to do that if you, you know, just put out 200,000 copies of a book, or more likely in Canada, 3,000 copies of a book, or maybe 500 copies of a book. But even so, they've been printed, they cost a lot of money, you can't fix that in the book except in a new edition, if you even get there. So the great benefit of working online is that you can do that, unless it's an email that you send in haste. And sending another one saying, well, what I really meant to say was, that doesn't work. So careful with your email. Yeah, Winifred's question was, or comment was, presumably, if you sent out a podcast and there's a typo in there, once people have downloaded it, the typo is there. And that's true, yes. So, for example, when I put out my wife's podcast a few days ago, I noticed that last week's episode, I had put the wrong episode number in one part of the show notes. So I fixed it, but chances are most of the people who are ever going to look at it already have the wrong one, and chances are they don't care. Because most of them, you know, the wrong episode number somewhere in the show notes, not a big deal. If I had accidentally, you know, libeled a famous world figure, I'd be in bigger trouble. Or is that slander? Which one is it? Libel is written?
Libel and print slander.
Okay. And so if I had spoken a slander in the podcast or written some libel in the show notes, or both, I'd be in trouble because I couldn't make it go away. And that's actually true on the web, too, because there are ways to find what you said. So if you erase it, it's not really quite erased. But anyway. So the kinds of skills that I've had to cultivate to do this and are different than what you might have had to cultivate in different media. Now, I have worked for magazines and in print, and you know, I did that before there was a web. So I have had some of those skills. I used the Letraset and the blue layout sheets that you took to the printer and all that. And even back in the day when I was doing my high school annual, we did all the stuff where it's, you just put the typewritten things there and let the typesetters figure it out. And say, we want this photo here and we want it cropped with a little grease pencil. And that was fun because they did all the hard stuff. And plus they looked out for typos and things too, which now you got to do all that yourself. But in the new medium, it's different. That sheet I passed out, did everybody get one or did we run out? Okay, I'll post it on my website anyway, so don't worry about it, and it'll be on the EAC site. That is a really quick cheat sheet that somebody else prepared, and in fact, they had a plain text version, and just before I came here, I made it prettier. It's a really quick cheat sheet on the very basic stuff of web code that you might need to know if you are, not if you're building a website, but if you are, for example, if somebody were to come and need to enter stuff into this website or my other website, or as I plugged at the beginning, if they wanted to take over from me for the editor's website. Anyway, for example, here, if I'm editing the main EACBC website, this is what I have to edit. And it looks like a mess, but if you look at that sheet and sort of examine what's going on here, it's pretty much entirely what that sheet is talking about. And over time, it's actually really simple. The way web code, HTML, works is there's something with these, you know, greater than, less than signs that are brackets. And there's one at the beginning that has brackets and something in it. And then at the end of whatever that element is, there's another one with a slash in front of it saying this part is over. So a paragraph will look like, and it doesn't have to be spaced like this. This is just for format. Paragraph will have a P at the beginning and a end of P at the end. And pretty much there's a bunch of other stuff, but the main part of building websites, that's all it involves. I was able in 1997 to make my first web page by going to one of these online tutorials and figuring this out. And I got something passable for the time up there in about an hour. It's not complicated. And if you're skilled at an editor, if you can run a word processor and you can, you know, manage your antivirus software, this is less complicated than that. Winifred's asking, what is the content management tool? The one that the national branch has set up is not a particularly good one, I will say, but it's okay. And what it does is it manages all, you know, so if we go back to here, this is the actual page we were looking at. It manages all the headers and the, you know, all this navigation down the side, and whenever I add a new page, it just automatically puts it in here in the navigation structure. It takes care of, if they decided to change all the color scheme and the fonts and everything else, you wouldn't have to change any of that other stuff that I was looking at. It would just get reformed. So essentially what I was editing was everything from here, everything over here. Just the content, the actual. And that cheat sheet I gave you will actually get you probably about 80 to 90% of what you need to do that tolerably well.
So is that, and that's the tool that all the branches, maybe any of the branches' websites.
Yeah, and I think for the most part, it's what the people at National Office do, unless there's somebody like me who is willing to do it for the branch. So most of the time you can, in fact, you know, before I was doing it, I think we just sent requests to National and said, can you change the website, please? Now, because there are limitations to the particular system they chose here, I do some other stuff behind the scenes manually in order to get the audio up there and other things going on. But that's because I know how. There's certainly no obligation to do that. I do a lot of things manually that really don't deserve to be done manually and should not be done manually. But I'm sort of like those people who, you know, when cars first came out, you had to know how to fix a car in order to run your car because it broke down every two blocks. I started back then, so I would be like, I'm not a car enthusiast now, but it's like the people who still take their carburetors apart, although cars don't have carburetors much anymore. But those sort of people, the people who change their own oil. I mean, why would you do that in any objective sense? It's not cheaper when you can go for, what, you know, $15? How much, what's your hourly rate? It's probably much cheaper and a lot less messy for you to go get somebody to do it. But there are people who change their own oil because that's what they do and it's fun for them. And similarly, hacking guts behind these things is fun for me. If you're going to do this sort of stuff for a living, you don't need to get into hacking the guts of stuff. It helps in some circumstances, but it can also hinder you because you get into that instead of doing what you're supposed to be doing, which is managing the words. And that sort of brings us around to a point I've made at previous talks like this here and in elsewhere, which is that the web in general is still a great place for text, because that's what it really is. Any good website that's any good at all, unless it's a game or something, or a cartoon perhaps, but even then, is based on words. And it's based on words that have to be interesting and valuable to somebody in order for anybody to ever go there. Because the website, any website is for the visitors to it. It's for the people who are coming to the website and trying to get something done or find something out or have some fun. I really think those three things, get something done, find something out, or have some fun, cover pretty much anything you would be doing on the web or, in fact, in many other media. If you can come up with a counterexample, please let me know, because I've been saying that for a while now. So what that means is that as somebody who's editing, for the web in particular, because it's sort of the biggest thing going here, and a place where you actually can make money doing this stuff, or for email, which is a related thing, or maybe for podcasts, or maybe for something else, what it's really about is creating interesting and compelling text, and it's creating interesting and compelling text for other people. Now, there's a whole industry called the search engine optimization industry, SEO. Let me call up something. I don't know. What have I got? I'll go to Wikipedia, because, hey, it's got everything, even if it's sometimes inaccurate. So SEO is called search engine optimization, and essentially it's a business where there are a lot of companies out there who will say, I can get you to the top of the search engine results in Google and 53,000 other search engines, who cares, in 2 weeks. And it's somewhat of a, I don't know if controversial is the right word. There's a lot of hucksterism in that there are a lot of people who say, I can get you to the top of the search results, but if you search for them, you can't find them. Which is not a good indicator, right? You figured they'd be able to do it for themselves. But the key thing about this is, it used to be, now, you know, most of you here are under the age of, 14? So you will have searched the web probably before Google. Is that right? Is anybody who has only ever used Google to search the web? If you recall what it used to be like before 1998, which is actually only how old Google is, that's not very long ago. That's when my daughter was born, and she's only grade 3. Before that, essentially the way it worked is the web... Are you reading all that? Maybe I should. Anyway, the web emerged in 1992. It was invented at a particle physics lab in Switzerland. And in that year, to the end of that year, I think there were 26 websites. And I visited some of them at the time. And over the next few years, it expanded rather rapidly, as you might have imagined. And by now, there are millions and millions of websites. And, in the early years, people realized there are getting to be rather a lot of these things, and you can't just have one big, one page that links to them all. We've got to start finding a way to search them. And the obvious way, from a computer science perspective, is to do what I call the Combine Harvester. They created software and big computer installations that acted like people surfing the web, except they could do it really fast and really dumbly. The programs would essentially follow all the links on all the websites they could find, and they would combine harvest all the words on those websites and chuck them into a big hopper, and then people wrote software that would go through the hopper and see what words were there in what order and next to each other. So when you searched for... Come up with a term you might search for.
Capital.
Capital? Okay. So when you searched for capital... or something more complicated like capital city or capital building, that those search engines would go through their massive hoppers of billions of words and say, well, here's a website that has frequent appearances of the words capital building in it, so it must be about a capital building. We'll give that as the first search result. Problem is, as anybody who used those services in those days will know, that a rather unsavory bunch of people who ran sites that were not about capital buildings discovered that if you put capital building at the top, at the bottom, or top of your website, or just in there somewhere, they'd show up at the top of the search results, even if they were actually about, well, all sorts of nasty things. So what that meant is that searching really didn't get you much good, because you got a lot of crap back. Sort of like all the spam you get in your email now. Same kind of thing. It was just junk. And what Google figured out, what the two guys who started it, who were smart PhD candidates at Stanford, and have since hired hundreds and hundreds and possibly thousands of other smart PhDs in the meanwhile, what they figured out is they went, well, there's a whole bunch of people who are building these websites. People building websites. And when they build their websites, they make links to other websites. And they don't, in general, link to useless websites. They link to ones that they think are useful. So when a website that you know is, if the, say, the New York Times, although they don't link much, but if they did, if they had a link saying, here is a picture of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., and they linked to one, chances are it would actually be a picture of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. So what Google did is they built software that not only looked at what all the words were, they still did the big combine harvest thing. They looked at all those words, and they also looked at websites and how they were linking to each other. So they effectively, as far as I understand it, and they keep it a pretty closely guarded secret, their original academic paper is online, and you can find it. But since then, they've pretty much shut up about it. Because, you know, they're making their money. But essentially what they did is they seeded their database like yeast. They found, you know, maybe 1,000 good websites that they knew by looking at them were authoritative and useful. And they put that stuff into the database and said, these websites are good. They have some reputation. They actually call it PageRank. And you can find out the PageRank of your own website. So a really, really, you know, like Google itself has a PageRank of 10 because they figure, you know, they're pretty authoritative. And so do, you know, websites that are 9 or 10 are like the New York Times and Microsoft and Apple. They're authoritative. When they say something, it's probably the word about that topic. Whether it's true or not is another question, but whatever. People tend to trust those sites. So, you know, it goes right from 10 down to 0, I guess. I don't know who gets 0, but I hope there are sites I hope have 0. Anyway, they set up this scheme and they have continually tweaked it. But what it means is that if you search for Capitol building in Google, as I will do now, and this is probably a different spelling than Graham was thinking of, but there you go. You get pictures of the Capitol building, architect of the Capitol building, whatever. You get something that's a reasonably good set of results for what you're looking at. And that's because Google looks at those words and said, okay, which authoritative websites have used the words Capitol building and pointed to another website? And how many of, you know, and it sort of looks and says, well, a bunch of these authoritative websites have pointed to this other website that has this picture on it, or that is this one, saying this is about Capitol building. And if enough of them have said that, we're going to make that top of the list. So essentially what they've done is they've recruited everybody who builds websites. And that doesn't just include people like me who get paid to do it. But anyone who has a blog, anyone who's ever posted in a forum that's online, anyone who's ever sent an email that gets republished somewhere on a mailing list thing that's a public mailing list that Google can find, any of that stuff. Or, you know, if you've written in your student newspaper and that gets published online, if you, the periodical of the organization you work for gets published online and it has links in it, if it's a PDF file that has links in it, if it's a Word document that has links in it, that all gets put into Google's giant combine harvester hopper, and they figure out from that what people are saying are reasonable links about all these different possible topics. And it's all automated, and it's got, you know, millions of, well, I don't know, at least hundreds of thousands of computers around the world, so that's how they can actually do it this quickly and come up with results about topics that people haven't actually inquired about before. That's the, you know, hard part for them. But what their genius was to recruit all those people, me, you, if you've ever done any of those things, to work for them for free. Everybody who builds a website is working for Google and making their search results better. So what that means is, as somebody who's work, you know, if you end up doing work that ends up on the web in some form, you should be aware of that. You should be aware that if you're, that the choices you make in what words you're using and what links you're making in particular, or what links you're instructing your web team to make, will inform everybody else about whether those links are valuable or not. So this leads to some interesting consequences, such as people setting up websites just to link to each other so that they all get better results. So Google has to fight against that. There's phenomenon which sort of came and went when people discovered how it worked, called the Google bomb, where you get a whole bunch of people with reasonably popular websites, sort of as a joke, to take a phrase that has nothing to do with something and all point to a particular website using that phrase. So saying, you know, top class idiot and pointing to the homepage of Bill Gates. So that when you search for top class idiot, you find Bill Gates. That was one sort of thing. Right, yeah, so that's the most recent example. And example was miserable failure pointing to George Bush. Now, some of that may have been intentional by people saying, we're all going to say miserable failure and point at the White House page or whatever. And a lot of it is just coming about people actually saying, thinking he's a miserable failure. So some of that's organic. Google bombing somebody. It doesn't happen as much as it used to. I mean, the thing is, you know, these things can come and go, and Google can sort of figure out what the patterns are and try and fight against it, and they're always tweaking it. But ultimately, that, you know, people will try to game that, and that's what the search engine optimization people do now, is they try to say, okay, you know, we're going to take advantage of the way Google does things, and, you know, so that we get your search results up to the top. But what I've discovered in my own work is that in a lot of, I mean, it certainly can work, and there are companies who do it honestly and find good ways to make it effective. But for me, I've found that a lot of it just happens if you make the content interesting and people link to it, because that's the way it's supposed to work. So if you're, you know, I wrote an article about it, about, SEO, I'm going to see if this works. Now, I just searched for my article and found it because I knew this phrase, it's no trick, was in it. So I wrote this article a couple years ago saying it's not really a trick to get your search engine ranking up there. Really what you need to do is write good stuff and make sure people know it's there and that they link to it. And I actually did an experiment in this thing where I talked about this fake company at the time called Great Plains Logistics, which didn't exist. And there I am, number 3 for that phrase. I was number 1 until Microsoft bought a company called Great Plains and put out a logistics program. So, you know, I'll take that hit, because that's actually what people should get when they're looking for that. But I made up this name, and I got there because I got a few people to link to me, and my site's reasonably well known. But somebody emailed me after that, and you may have heard this story before at one of my other talks, but what they emailed me and said, well, okay, that's great for you. You've got a blog, you know, you're writing about these topics, and you've been around for a while. But I work for a shoe company, and we sell shoes online, and there's a million of those. And how, you know, I've got to use this search engine optimization technology where people are sort of playing tricks in order to get us up the search results when people look for buying shoes. And, well, there might have been a point there, but I responded, probably not, because I think if you took the money that you were going to have to spend on those people and either hired somebody or found somebody in your company to write an article once a week, honestly evaluating some of the shoes that you sell, saying, here's 3 hiking boots that we sell at these 3 different price points. We've tried them out. These mid-range ones are pretty good. The really expensive ones suck because they're actually slippery and you fall off a rock when you're walking on them. And the cheap ones fall apart after 2 weeks or, you know, whatever. Or they're okay if you're going out, you know, once every 3 months to go hiking, but don't use them if you're planning to, you know, hike the Squamish Chief or something. Short little article, put it out once a week, evaluate different stuff. I bet if you did that, people who care about shoes, and there's people who care about everything on the internet, people who care about shoes would start linking to you. And eventually, when people were looking for honest reviews about shoes, they'd end up on your site. And all you would have done is actually write honest reviews about shoes. And that seems to be the way it should work. The question is, how do synonyms affect this? You know, shoes as opposed to footwear. Google and the other search engines are actually pretty good about that. They they've hired all these PhDs. They thought of that. And if you're searching for one thing, you'll probably first find sites that are referring to that specific term, but ones that are related to that, and misspellings of it, and words that are a few words apart, but, you know, it's the same close to phrase, will tend to bubble up in the results the same way. So, you know, if I search for, Apple computer with one P, I still end up with, you know, Apple computer results, and they say, did you mean Apple computer with two P's? They got most of that handled, so that's not...
So what's it, www.apple.apple.com?
Probably don't want to know.
Shall we risk it? Here we go. Oh, a bunch of ads where you go somewhere else to buy apples. So somebody bought it and basically is using it as a way to try to make some money. So we were lucky. People try it, but you know, Google figured that out too, and they actually say, well, if this text is white and the background is white, we're actually going to make the rank go down because you're trying to trick us. So that used to work. Doesn't really work as well anymore. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, if the site is useful in other ways, and if people are linking to it, then that may get offset somewhat. Nobody knows exactly what the secret sauce is because Google keeps changing it. And the comment was that Google actually penalizes you if you use some of these tricks because some of them are, there's no other reason you would do them. And I forget exactly what they did, but BMW, one of BMW's websites, did something somewhat nefarious last year. And Google actually pulled it right out of the index. So if you searched for BMW, you couldn't find their site. And then they brought it back after BMW went, So they do that. Yes? The question was meta tags, which if you look at a website like mine, and... Oh, one sec. Gotta wait for it to load. You can view source here on any website. And this shows you that code I'm talking behind. And you will see stuff like this, description, website of Eric Miller, blah, 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 keywords, whatever. These keyword tags, Google pretty much ignores them now. They used to be useful in the old days, but because people abused them, they're not really much use. This description one is still useful because I notice it comes up in search results. So that's something. The other one that's really useful is this, where have I got it? My page is so full of crap. Here we go. This one, title. Which in my case says, penmachine.com, Derek K. Miller, writer and editor of Vancouver, Canada. If you look up at the top there, that's where that comes from. So every web page at the top in your web browser has a title. That's different from this heading. It's a title at the top of the page. And the implication of the way web pages are structured is that that title at the top describes what the page is about.
And
if you print it, yeah. So that's not a shocking thing. The title of the web page is... the title of the web page. Nice tautology there. But Google places a fair amount of weight on that, and so do a lot of other things, because they assume that it's actually about what it's about. So if you see one that says untitled up there, they're wasting some Google juice there. Now, I'll get to your question in a sec, but I just want to... I don't want to get too obsessed about this, because search engines aren't what the web is about. My main message is that, you know, we're all co-opted into this Google searching thing, and people search to find things initially. But it's really about people, and that's, I'll get to that after I answer the question. Don't get obsessed with the search engines, because that's not the only thing. So, sorry, what was your question? The question is, how important is it to link to other pages? It is important. The web is a web because it's made of links. It is important, but there's a balance there. You don't want every second word in your paragraph to be a link to something, because, you know, then... first of all, it looks bad. Second of all, if people follow all those links, they're never going to be able to read a sentence. It's important to link where the link provides something additional and useful for the person who's reading the material. You shouldn't be linking in order to, you know, perform some sort of trick. You should be saying, you know, for example, here, I'm saying I'm speaking to the Editors Association of Canada. And when you click on there, you get to the Editors Association of Canada website, because I presume, probably reasonably, that somebody reading that would want to find out what that is. And rather than me going into a big, long description, I just say, here, go over and look at what they've written. It's a, you know, it's like a, treat it in many ways the way you would treat a citation in any kind of academic paper. If you say something and you need something to back it up, that's what a link is for. Or if something interesting or, you know... In my case, the rule I've done for my posts in here, so each one of these is a post, and some of them are really long and some of them are really short. My general rule of thumb has been I need to have at least one link in there. Otherwise, why am I writing it? You know, I could write just, you know, the soup I had this afternoon really sucked. You know, I just want to complain. And I occasionally do that. But my instinct, as somebody who's sort of gotten into this medium, is I would find a funny cartoon about somebody who didn't like their soup, or a picture of some soup, or something else that I'd written about soup before, maybe the one I really liked, or a link to the restaurant where the sucky soup was. And I would put that in there, you know, linked on the word soup or something. And in a really long thing, I might link, you know, a couple times in a paragraph or maybe once. It's not a hard and fast rule, but what you want to be doing is providing some additional useful stuff and having somewhere for people to go. Yes? The question is, how do your outbound links affect whether search engines find you? I don't actually know. I suspect they may put that in there somewhere. It's mostly about links coming into your site. Now, there's a secondary effect there. If you link out, chances are the people you're linking out to might link back to you because they will probably figure out that you were linking there. So it's sort of, as a social thing, it encourages more traffic to your site. And it's sort of the opposite of what you might think. You might think, well, once people are where I am, I want to keep them here. And that used to be, in the early days of the web, that was the sort of mantra. It's the, you know, you've got the walled garden. And a lot of newspapers, I noticed, still do this. You go to the New York Times, you go to the Globe and Mail, or you go to Canada.com, they never send you anywhere else. They just send you somewhere else in their website because they want to keep you there. But what's the most successful website in the world? Google. What do? They send you away. That's all they do. And you keep coming back. And my website's the same. I, you know, often it's just, here's this neat thing I found today. Go away. And if I do that enough, they come back. So, yes. Okay, I'll get that to you. In fact, you can fire away with questions anytime because I'm sort of running out of steam and we're running out of time. So, I mean, I could go on and on, as you can tell, but I may as well go on and on about something you're interested in. So, at Google, say I was looking for the end of the world. So, there's a lot of sites about the end of the world. But the interesting thing here is if you notice, what it actually searched for was and a world. And it excluded the and of the, because they're common words and they probably exist on every single website out there. And it actually was looking for end of the world and you know, if it was a more obscure phrase, it might find words that were a fair distance apart. So, for example, two words, capital and stress. So you have, you know, capital stress reliever, but then you get stuff down here, stress reliever, capital. You get words that are close, not necessarily in the same order. It's trying to figure out what's most useful with those two words in proximity to one another. If you put quotes around it, you're saying, I want that phrase and only that phrase in that order with nothing in between it. So it's saying, that's exactly what I'm looking for. So if I search for that, some of those other links go away because the only links that are there are capital and stress next to each other. And there are other things you can do. You can do ors and ands, and I don't actually know how a lot of that works. But the quotes basically say, I want this entire phrase. So if you say, the end of the world, it will look for the entire phrase. It may still try to exclude the and, thes, and whatever, but it will give you results that only have that. And you'll get fewer results, so there's only 4.9 million instead of 50 million. So what Winifred was saying, for the benefit of the website audience, is that if you're looking for a particular name, putting quotes around it makes sure that you get that name and that name only in that form only. So for example, in this case, if I go Derek Miller, you get Derek Miller, the musician who's more famous than I am and who's won Juno Awards, and then you get me. And in fact, you'd get that same result if you put it in quotes because it's obvious. But if I look for Derek K. Miller, or actually if I look for Derek Miller in quotes, let's try this. Oh, you still get me. Okay.
But there's less of them.
Yeah, there's less. And you get more where it's just those two words together. Or if you're looking for Daphne Sams, you find a number of instances here. If we search for it without quotes, let's see if we get a similar result or not. We get things in different order because.
And if you scroll down farther, you see, you know, Daphne and Sam.
Yeah, so then you get, you know, Sam, Daphne's at the beginning, you get some other people named Sam. It's a lot easier. So it's good for names, it's good for specific phrases. You can do other restricted things, like, here's a tip I use a lot. Actually, let's go to the homepage, because it's bigger. If you want to search a particular website and no other website, you can say, I want to search site. So if you do site:apple.com, technical support. So what this phrase at the beginning here, site, you can hardly see it. Let me zoom in. Isn't that a neat trick? site:apple.com, technical support. You get results only from apple.com. And there's a bunch of other things you can do there. You can do things that are linking in. You can do, I don't even know them all. Somewhere on Google, there's a thing that helps you with that. Search for it. Somebody had a question at the back. And you could probably, I think this would work. Monty Python minus snakes. Like that. I'm not sure this is going to work, so I'm hoping. This is all about Monty Python and not about snakes. And in fact, it would probably exclude any skit in which Monty Python actually mentioned a snake. So, anyway. We're coming to time?
So,
are there some more questions? Because we're getting towards the end and we just want to wrap it up. But feel free to talk to me afterwards, too. Yes, Michael. Okay, the question was, and somebody else wants to address it, too, that on the web, a lot of people don't seem to think they need editors, and it's hard to convince them that they do, and a lot of them will put up stuff, and it'll be a mess, and they'll never update it, and how do you convince them that they actually should pay for your services to help them? So the suggestion there, again, for the benefit, the thing there was, if you find a website that has editorial problems of whatever sort, if you politely point out to them that perhaps they could use your assistant, you will get some hostile responses, some lack of responses, and maybe some business. So that's one option. The other thing is, you need to look at the site and see whether it's the type of site that people would care. If it's a site for a business, where they are expecting to get, at some point, money out of this, and and it's riddled with errors, and it looks horrible, and the writing's bad, you might want to point out to them some of these things that, you know, people are not going to be too interested in reading this website, and they might not actually, or, you know, it can be really simple things. I came to your website, and I noticed that there's no phone number on it, and it doesn't say where you are, including what city you're in. And because it's a website, you know, people might be ending up on your website, and they're in, you know, and you sell cars, and, you know, you're in New York City, or you're in New Jersey, and I'm in Vancouver, and I can't find out from your website that you're in New Jersey, so I might ask you about buying a car, and you can't help me. You know, here are some suggestions about how you want to improve it, if you'd be interested, blah, 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 blah. Go on from there. Bigger firms, firms who take these things more seriously probably will get that more than others, and especially now that the web's been around and it's important, that becomes less of a problem. There are always going to be those people and those sites that don't care or who are actively hostile, and there's going to be a lot of websites that are crap. It's because it's an easy publishing medium. Anybody can put a website up, and that means there's going to be, anybody is going to. So, but what it is there's a lot of stuff, you know, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be quality too, so I think you can find that. So to Michael's point, Michael asked, what do I think of this Web 2.0 thing? Now, you may not have heard of that. Has anybody heard of Web 2.0? Anybody know what it means? Good, because nobody actually does. Web 2.0 actually started as the name of a conference that this company O'Reilly, you've seen the technical books, they have a very distinctive editorial style for their books. The books are white. They're about this big. They have a sort of colored title on them, and they have an old sort of woodcut picture of some animal on them. So if you look in technical bookstores, there's usually a whole section of these animal books, and they're old-style woodcuts of owls and lemurs and giraffes and whatever else, but they're about web programming, for example. It's just they came up with this neat idea. But anyway, they put on a conference as well, and they started it 2-3 years ago and called it the Web 2.0 conference, essentially implying that that whole big, you know, the web started and it came along and there was the big bubble and then it burst and everybody lost a bunch of money, and now we're moving into the next phase. It's not a bad name for a conference, but it sort of got co-opted into, you know, in a semi-friendly way by a bunch of people who are building the new categories of websites, and it's sort of has come to encompass certain technologies that people use on the web, in some ways certain trends in what websites look like. So one of the ones that's famous for this is this one called 37 Signals. They make some software. Really clean, simple, rounded corners, kind of glossy, globby looking. It's just a trend. But that sort of is part of this Web 2.0 thing. And also the main thing is that the Web 2.0 idea implies that the people who are on the web are getting more involved in making it. So the website I actually initially got this photo, well, it's my photo, but the place I had put it and where I got it from is this photo sharing website called Flickr, which started here in Vancouver. Oops. And now got bought by Yahoo. And what it is it's a website where you can post your photos online and you can get them printed and you can do other stuff, but you can do a whole bunch of other things. And for example, I posted this photo today, which is not a photo that I took, but I credited who I got it from and what I can do is I can automatically click this blog this button and the photo ends up on my website because I changed some settings there. It was easier for me to upload the photo to this website and then click this button than it would have been to put the photo on my website myself. It's faster for me to do it this way because this one automatically resizes it and makes all the code and stuff when I do that. So all I had to do was say upload and then blog and I was done. So it has this mechanism of sort of connecting websites together. And then this guy that I know, Chris Krug, left a comment on my photo saying, I want this. What this is there's an entire computer server room inside this shipping container and they can take it anywhere. And basically, as long as there's water and power and an internet connection, you can run a web company with this shipping container. So he says, I want this. So he can comment on my photos. And I can look which photos have people commented the most about. And it creates this, there's this huge community of people who use this photo web sharing site. And almost none of them ever print their photos there. They're mostly just looking at other people's photos and putting theirs up and commenting about them and putting these random tags about them. So, you know, I put the tag shipping container here. If I click on that, wait for a second, and then I click on another thing. It says, show me all the public photos that say shipping container. Here's a whole bunch of photos about shipping containers. And I click most interesting. And these are the photos about shipping containers that other people on Flickr have made the most comments about and said they are their favorite. And, you know, they look, and what you find is you end up with some really nice pictures of shipping containers if you need any. This is sort of what they call a Web 2.0 website. It's a site that's not just there telling you stuff. It's, here's a website that we have built so that you can do things with other people. So that's what this Web 2.0 idea is kind of about. And what that means is that it's somewhat of a controversial term because people say, well, nobody really knows what it means, and there's sort of a bunch of trendy things in it that aren't really, and it's not really the next web. It's just, you know, so people are saying, well, now I'm going to make a Web 2.2, whatever that's going to mean. Or would some people have said, well, why don't we, you know, every time there's an economic depression or decline, we'll just say it's a new economy. So we're at economy 75.2 now. Anyway, the terminology doesn't matter so much. It's saying that the web is moving in a different direction now. And if you're going to get involved in wordsmithing for it, you'll need to understand that maybe you'll be writing stuff that other people will be contributing to in some way. So that if you look at so, for example, here, every time I come to my Flickr homepage here, it has a different language here saying hello. So, you know, every once in a while, it will actually say hello, but most of the time, it says something else. Ni hao. And the style of writing on this website is very breezy and very, like, for example, when I log in, instead of saying sign in, it used to say get in there. And it used to be this was almost the whole page. It was like, here's your login, get in there. Oh, okay, so let's see if it still says that. Get in there. And that's the whole login, right? There's a style to it. And if you were to go work for them, you'd have to learn that style. Because people, when they have, here's a good example. Last year they had a server failure. Their site went down for hours on end, which is not supposed to happen when you're owned by Yahoo. So what did they do? They had a coloring contest. on their webpage, they had a picture.
Let's see if I can find.
So they had this image, and it was essentially just this. A page with their logo as these two dots that are a different color. And they said, color this in any way you want, and send in your coloring things and post them up on Flickr when it comes back, and tag it with this particular tag, and we're going to pick a random number of people and give them prizes. Because, you know, we shouldn't have gone down, so we're going to have a coloring contest. That is not the IBM way of responding to a IT crisis. But if you look at them, there's some amazing stuff that people did. Like, for example, it was a piece of paper with two circles on it. Somebody cut it and shone a light through it and took a picture of that. And, you know, here's a guy dressed up as a stormtrooper. And then people have done all sorts of wacky, you know, here's the easy button from Staples, and so on. So people did all sorts of creative things. And there was this explosion of creativity and people going, oh, that's great, and I love that, and whatever. The company took a massive failure of their very core business and turned it into a way where their users loved it. Magic, right? And so you need to, if you're getting involved in this kind of stuff, what this says is that they're thinking not only in their own self-interest, which they are, but they're thinking about their users all the time. So that they say, okay, how could we, despite the fact that we have really annoyed the people who make us our living, how can we make it so they feel less bad about that? How can we make it so they might even feel good about it? And what they actually did is they got so many responses, and I don't know if they planned this. I doubt they did because it was such a crisis. They gave anybody who submitted anything, you know, a free month of extra storage and some extra features and stuff like that. So you can pay them for a year of that stuff, but they gave you a month of it for free if you submitted anything at all. And that was just, you know, because it doesn't really cost them much to do that. And it made everybody feel great. And the way they wrote those messages was all in a style that was very lighthearted and yet accurate and clear. So that's that. You get into that sort of thing. But if you're writing for CNN, or you're writing for IBM, or you're writing for somebody else, you're not going to write like that. So the house style is going to change a lot, and you might be swinging back and forth among those. Just as if, in the print world, if you were working for, you know, if you were proofreading the Chicago Manual of Style, or you're proofreading Mad Magazine, they're two different kinds of tasks. Mad Magazine will not mind if you put 5 exclamation marks in a row. Chicago Manual will. So, there you go. I think I'll finish at that. If you have any further questions, go to my website, penmachine.com. Grab a business card. There's a bunch there. My website's also on that piece of paper. Or just come talk to me. This is one of the other things about the web, is you don't know where your stuff's going to end up. You could publish it on there, and it might, depending on how you authorize things, it may get republished or linked to in all sorts of strange ways. So there we go, I'm done.
Thank you.
Again, it'll be on the website. I'll have a bunch of stuff on my website. The next one will be the third Wednesday in November.